though for some reason it seems like Wednesdays are sort of equivalent, diffeomorphic to Mondays in terms of starting at 9 a.m. So today I want to talk about different ways we can hide extra dimensions. So this is also linking in with the homework that you were given yesterday, I think. So David's got a nice homework prepared on it. Now that's torture, bringing in that beautiful platter in front of me. It's really unfair. I think I might take a wander and snaffle something off the plate there. So originally, up until this century, we used to imagine that if we had extra dimensions, they would all be wrapped up on an extremely small scale. I mean, we're not talking about our small scale, we're talking about sort of standard model particle physics small, even smaller. Then the Kaluza-Klein compactification would have essentially, other than the gravitational sector, the scalar, or various moduli of the internal manifold, different degrees of freedom, distortions, that they would be the only way that the extra dimensions would leave an imprint on our world. However, one of the interesting developments, I think, in the last couple of decades is that we now realize there's another way of hiding extra dimensions. Instead of making them absolutely tiny, sort of Planck scale tiny, which to some extent, actually, we're not even sure if that's, you know, how well defined that is, we can make them small in terms of our scales or gravity scales, but not necessarily as small when we look at the sort of particle physics scale. And so if we recall when we did Kaluza-Klein theory, that we already saw a shift in Newton's constant, which included a sort of factor of the volume, although in this case it was just the size of the internal direction, we saw we got a difference between our Planck scale and the higher dimensional Planck scale. And so if we kind of translate that up to an arbitrary number of extra dimensions, let's say in this case n extra dimensions, then we can perhaps generate an even bigger difference between our Planck scale and the true fundamental Planck scale. So to get an idea of what sort of put some numbers to it, if we look for our compactification scale, if we just assume naively initially, just as a working assumption, the scale on which we would compactify is given by inverse Planck scale times this ratio, hierarchy ratio, between our Planck scale and higher dimensional Planck scale to some dimensional dependent power. So we know our Planck scale is of order 10 to the 18, 10 to the 19 GV. So we can kind of translate this into units that we have some feel for. So if we do it in terms of, if we represent our higher dimensional Planck scale in terms of something that makes sense from a particle physics perspective, TV, and then we put our lengths in something else that makes sense, or at least is we have a feel for, centimeters, then this is kind of what we get. So we're sort of comparing our fundamental Planck scale to a sort of TV scale, and then we get n is the number of extra dimensions, and so this spits out a characteristic sort of size, something that sets the size for the internal dimensions. So example, if we say n equals 6, so that's 6 extra dimensions, and we say md is like of order, well, we know it has to be higher than this, but let's say 10 TV. then our length is really small, at least by our gravitational standards. So this means that we get a length that's kind of too small to probe gravitationally. But it's large enough to give a nice hierarchy. So one of the reasons, this was essentially the reason people began to explore these models, at least phenomenologically, as an alternative to using supersymmetry to solve the hierarchy problem. So it's saying, it's sort of saying pictorially, if you like, that gravity is weakened by spreading out in the extra dimension. So, I mean, admittedly, I haven't yet dealt with the fact why particle interactions don't spread out, but at least just looking at it from the gravitational perspective, if we think about gravitational interactions and then the coupling of gravity to matter, provided our matter stays four-dimensional, then we've weakened gravity without necessarily having a weak gravity at some in the fundamental theory. So it saves us having to sort of worry about hierarchy in the same way. So I guess if I sketched it from a Kaluza-Klein perspective, this would be, if I sort of think about the, you know, gravitational lines of force spreading out, so at high scales, gravity should be four-dimensional, but the strength of gravity from a particular source is weakened because, if you like, you know, when we think of our lines of force, they've got to spread over the internal dimension. So this is just kind of giving a pictorial feel for why gravity is weakened. I mean, we see it from the Lagrangian perspective, right? But in essence, what would have been just this single line, which is standing for four dimensions, now has to spread out over the circle. So that's kind of dropped its strength. So it's all very well, but how do we have this picture of a little spot in the extra dimension that's completely orthogonal to the Kaluza-Klein point of view, where everything's kind of smeared over the extra dimension, which is a killing vector or killing direction? So this is really the challenge, or, you know, this is the sort of keystone of what's happening. So what it means is that we have to confine particle physics to a surface or a submanifold. So we've already kind of thought about this a little bit. When I was discussing the domain wall, I introduced it in the context of an example of field theory interacting with gravity. So we looked at a scalar field, we added a potential, it had two distinct minima, and then we thought, well, what happens if we have two different domains, one the negative vacuum, one the positive vacuum, and the field interpolated between the two? And when we looked at the configuration of the field, we saw it was quite strongly localized. It had this set to the fourth profile. So that looked like something sharply localized in extra dimensions, and therefore, at least notionally, it looked like a lower dimensional surface. So I'm going to give at least a motivational reason as to how you get confinement, just with a specific toy example. So remember, we have the double well potential. Lambda was the coupling. Well, up to a factor of two is the quartic coupling. Eta is the vevify in the vacuum. And so we see that our field nicely interpolates between one vacuum and the other. So now I want to couple this scalar field to a fermion, a Dirac fermion. So our scalar, in a sort of not unfamiliar fashion, gives a mass to the fermion, and these are five-dimensional Dirac matrices sitting here. So if we were sitting in a plus or minus, if we were sitting in the vacuum of phi, we would have a definite result for this fermion. But because we're in this interpolating background, it's kind of a little bit less clear what's going to happen to the solutions for psi. So if we look at our equation of motion and assume, first of all, that we'll look for a profile for the fermion on the background of the domain wall. So I've just, that said, naught's just a sort of degree of freedom of where the wall's zeroed, and I'm just going to set it to zero. It's not important. So this is my equation of motion for the psi field. And it actually has a solution. So psi has a profile that kind of tracks the domain wall. So you can kind of check that this works, where we have to have a condition on psi naught, which is actually has the structure of a four-dimensional fermion. A four-dimensional Dirac spinner. So that's saying that psi naught is actually what we would call chiral. So that's just a background profile, and it's actually quite a nice example of how when you have these non-trivial solutions, sometimes, they can back react on other fields. Yep.
Fifth gamma matrix, right?
Yes.
It's not necessarily the gamma 5 that we have in four dimensions.
It is actually.
So
if you look at the spinner representations, so in five dimensions, you kind of have this is the fifth gamma matrix. So.
It's really pi times gamma 0.1 this thing that we use for.
It is the same gamma 5. It's just one of those things about how many you know, the dimension of the spinner representation in however many space-time dimensions you're in. So I know that in 4D we have constraints. We can have, you know, Majorana fermions or Weyl fermions. Here we've got a genuine Dirac spinner, which, you know, we add gamma 5. It's the same sort of dimension of the representation. So it's just one of those. I mean, there could well be subtleties, but I'm just giving the headline story here that you get, you know, you could. There's also ways you can couple scalars to get this same effect. And what's really happening is the presence, the scalar field gives a mass to the fermion when it has a non-zero VeV, but inside the core, the scalar field is zero, so your fermion is like massless, essentially. And so it's actually a lower, it's a lower energy configuration for this spinner field to actually have a non-trivial profile. So if this is our wall, you know, we get it's a bit broader, but we do get this profile. So the psi, if you like, condenses. On the wall. So it's that sort of picture. So now if we ask, what are the low energy excitations of this spinner? Well, they can actually have some space-time dependence, provided if I sort of look at my, now thinking about my general equation for this five-dimensional spinner, if I assume it's like a product of that profile, the profile that's the condensate profile, times some psi naught of x, it'll still solve the equation, provided it satisfies a massless field equation. So it's one of these things where, so this was kind of first. First kind of put forward by Rubikov and Shaposhnikov, I think it's the early 80s, and where they noticed that, you know, people had already got the idea of these domain walls, these topological defects, in the 60s and 70s, both in the context of field theory, where we call them more topological defects, as well as in the context of condensed matter, sort of looking at, you know, these same vacuum defects. And there's an awful lot of similarities between these two really rather different, notionally different objects. Because we're dealing with defects in, you know, some quite high energy field theory, but they have, you know, the Higgs mechanism is kind of very similar to explaining superconductivity. So we have links between sort of Higgs vortices and superconducting vortices, and these domain walls are really exactly like magnetic domains and domain walls there. So the idea of the condensates and looking at their low energy excitations had already been figured out, again, during the 70s. And then Rubikov and Shaposhnikov put these ingredients together in a quite nice sort of physics letters B paper called Is Our Universe a Domain Wall? So I guess it's one of those exceptions to my rule or my theorem before when I said if a paper has a question mark, the answer's no. But I think they left it open because, you know, they just observed that there was this really cute correspondence, but they couldn't necessarily get everything to add up at the time. So this is a simple toy model of confinement. So you can do the same thing for scalars. Vectors are a little bit tricky, but at least what it does is it gives a proof of concept. It's saying that it's not completely outrageous to imagine a construct where we're highly localized in terms of the extra dimension, and excitations, the field theory, the excitations around that particular vacuum defect, at least look four-dimensional. Now, obviously, they're not exactly four-dimensional because there is a spectrum in which you get massive particles going into the bulk, but the assumption is that there's a gap and the energy of those extra excitations is higher than the energy that we are probing.
This is saying
that we're now, this is a chiral fermion, so we've still got this relation with the gamma 5, but we're just summing over the four-dimensional four-dimensional part, because we've taken care of the Z dependence. So we're saying psi, five-dimensional psi, is psi naught of x, right, times this profile, let's call it g of z, the Sech piece, yeah? So this takes care of the z dependence, and this is now just a four-dimensional equation of motion. This, obviously, they've got the same number of components, these two. So as an equation of motion, it looks like a 4D equation of motion. So the real reason, I guess, that Rubikoff and Shaposhnikov kind of left it a bit of an open question was that they realized it's not just enough to have confinement of particles. It's a bit pointless having your particles nicely confined to the brain if gravity can go all over the place and doesn't look like our standard Einstein gravity in four dimensions. So again, this was actually sort of partly worked out at the time during the 80s, but somehow not in a, I don't know, perhaps not so well communicated, or maybe just a little, in a bit of an obscure fashion. So what I'm going to illustrate this with is, again, another toy model, wall. In anti-de Sitter space. So this is known as the Randall-Sundrum model. And it is the sort of simplest example of what we call a warped compactification. So the ideas of having a warped compactification are kind of used a lot more generally, but the intuition that people use when they, say, take some warp throat on some sort of Kähler manifold all come from this kind of picture. So we'll do, because we can, we've got everything, we've set up all the machinery, we'll actually look at this specific example. So to do that, we just need to recall a couple of things. Our gravitational action had two pieces. So if we're thinking, if we have a wall, we might try to describe it by saying we've got the bulk gravitational, the five-dimensional gravitational field, which is sort of the dynamics of which are determined by this thing here. And then we've got the wall, which could have its own dynamics and its own interaction, and that's going to speak to this part. So so if we vary our boundary metric or allow our boundary metric to vary, then this Gibbons-Hawking boundary term, or you know, the whole residual, what ends up contributing, is this combination of extrinsic curvatures. So we can view the wall, which is now being promoted to a brain world. It's a world that we live on, it's a brain. So we're going to view our space-time, maybe it's easier to sketch it, as a composite. This is our wall or our brain. Of two bulks, so two manifolds, M, with a boundary, each has a boundary. And so the idea is that the boundary of M plus is the plus side of the wall, and the boundary of M minus is the minus side of the wall. So this is the wall. I've kind of drawn it as a finite thickness, but you know, the idea is that using this description, it would be like an infinitesimal thickness. So the idea is that we source our wall by something that's approximately a delta function. So we kind of talked about this when we found the energy momentum tensor of the domain wall solution. And so obviously our sigma, which is the boundary of each manifold, tells us, you know, that has to be a well-defined submanifold. So that tells us that the boundaries have to agree. So what that means is that if I look at my boundary prescription, it's saying that the sort of jump in extrinsic curvature has to be equal to this energy momentum source. Now I say it's a jump, even though in fact in this notation I'm adding k of n plus and k of n minus. I'm just going to put inverted commas around that. But notice that n plus and n minus are kind of pointing in the opposite direction. And that's because when we do this boundary prescription, our normal always lies inside the manifold. So these are called the Israel equations. Or junction conditions. Although, conventionally, So what Werner Israel did was he looked at the Einstein equations for an actual sort of spread out source. So he assumed the source wasn't a delta function. And so the normal field was actually continuous. So his n minus was the opposite sign to this boundary prescription. So in the case of the Israel equations, so he was taking, so the thickness of the wall is delta, he looked at the Einstein equations, in this case, obviously, he was doing four-dimensional gravity, and he looked at the Einstein equations, four-dimensional Einstein equations, presuming that there was a very sharp sort of at peak of energy momentum tensor spread out over a surface. And he found that if you just had one extra dimension, so that just one sort of transverse dimension, there was a well-defined delta function limit, so normal Dirac delta function. And it meant that you could effectively forget about the detailed internal structure of a shell source and just treat it as this infinitesimal source with a jump in extrinsic curvature. So for the Israel junction conditions, they're normally written as a difference. We flip the sign of that negative normal and write it as a difference. So just one of those, basically with codimension one, the non-linearities of gravity don't kill you. Yep?
This HAB is metric?
Yeah, it's the first fundamental form. It's annoying. It's just that it's conventional to call the first fundamental form H, and also, as you saw yesterday, was it yesterday? Perturbation of the metric tensor H. Just an annoying notational bug.
In this sense, I kind of expect a stress energy-like thing up here.
Stress energy what, sir?
Like a stress energy term on the right-hand side.
Should it be SAB rather than HAB on the left?
Oh, thank you.
Yes,
I'm jumping ahead. I'm thinking, yep, thank you. Thanks, sorry about that. I couldn't see it myself. Yeah, it's coupling to the stress tensor. Yeah, you're right. Thanks for that. Okay, so that's just a brief aside introducing these junction conditions. Actually, I think Israel was interested in sort of gravitational collapse, so he was looking at shells of matter. So it doesn't have to be, you know, these. We're now going to look at the energy momentum tensor of the wall, which is proportional to the metric, which is probably why I slipped up and put an H there. But you can do it for any equation of state between the pressure terms parallel to the wall and the energy term. So that's kind of, you know, it's kind of a nice aspect of his work. So Randall-Sundrum. The Randall-Sundrum model is a wall in ADS. So this is what it looks like, and then I'll explain why. So here, if I write mu nu, I hope I'll be consistent. Mu nu are the space-time indices. So their particular solution has a flat wall metric. It's got a normal z, which is the proper distance away from the wall. And then it's got this prefactor. Remember, we had our prefactor when we looked for the space-time of a domain wall. And this prefactor is very sharply peaked on the wall. Now, at the time when I talked about finding the wall metric, I made the metric parallel to the wall a constant curvature space. So in vacuum, we found that we needed an expanding wall, a sort of de Sitter sort of induced metric. But here, this is flat. So you should be just thinking, okay, are you sure you can do that? I mean, the key thing here is the fact we're in anti-de Sitter. So remember, black holes are holes in vacuum and de Sitter, but they can be holes, planes, or hyperbolic surfaces in ADS. So it's not entirely implausible. But we do have to just check that this is a legitimate potential solution. So the wall, or the space-time, has Z2 symmetry. So you can see that because I put a mod Z there. So what that means is that my extrinsic curvature just swaps sign across the wall. So it's sufficient for me to just look at things on one side of the wall. So on the plus side, my normal is just d by dz, automatically unit. So that means my covector components minus 1. My extrinsic curvature basically says take the covariant derivative of n and project everything down parallel to the wall. So on the plus side, my warp factor looks like e to the minus 2kz. So the derivative of g mu nu with respect to z is just minus 2 times g mu nu. So my k plus mu nu just picks up a constant k times the parallel components of the metric. So therefore, if I look at the Israel conditions, my k mu nu is just my delta k is just twice k plus. So that's minus 2k g mu nu. And then I have to evaluate it at the wall, which is at z equals 0. So this is minus 2k eta. So that's what my delta k is. So that tells me if I look at s, what should my wall energy momentum tensor be? So I simply put in what I just calculated for the extrinsic curvature. And I find that my stress tensor is proportional to the induced metric times a specific constant. Now, we know, for the domain wall at least, that the stress tensor is proportional to the parallel or induced metric. So that's good. So that's kind of one tick, makes us happy. We've got the right shape for the energy momentum tensor. So this is good news. However, we have to take, if you remember, sigma was our energy per unit area. So sigma, in this case, we see is equal to 6k over 8 pi g. So we can have a flat solution, but it's got a very precisely tuned energy momentum tensor. So just as a sort of our cosmological constant is the K is the inverse length scale for ADS, which is determined by the cosmological constant. So it says that we can have a flat brain provided its energy momentum tensor has a specifically tuned value with respect to the cosmological constant. So we usually sort of, I guess we just call this the tension. I mean, the brain energy momentum tensor has the energy equal to the tension. So we're saying with this fine-tuned tension, we have a solution. So what happens to gravity? So what you're going to, basically two different ways that you can derive the effect of gravity in the four-dimensional brain world, and I sort of left it open as to which one I would cover depending on time. I think that looks very long. I think I'm going to do the shorter one. So you can do perturbation theory. So just like we were doing yesterday, in which case you do that Lichnerovich operator, and you look at the solutions for the Lichnerovich operator. You find out, you basically again do separation of variables, and you find the eigenfunctions in the transverse space. You then, so you find the Green's function. And then you observe that if you put in a source on the brain, it looks like, to leading order, Einstein gravity. So instead, what I'm going to do is a slightly different approach, which uses this Gauss-Kodaczy type of formalism. And we're just going to look at the effect of some little fluctuation on the brain and how that feeds in to the Ricci tensor on the brain. So we're sort of going to do linearized gravity on the brain, but with the complication of having the bulk along for the ride. So I think the homework actually explores more perturbation theory. Is that correct, David, in Randall's syndrome? He's going like this. So.
Well,
sort of. Okay. Right, so we're going to add a little bit of energy momentum to our brain. We're just going to make it just not be quite perfect. And we're going to say that we go just a little bit away from the Minkowski metric on the brain. We're going to ignore bulk effects. We don't actually have to. This is really more so I can keep the algebra that I'm going to do under control rather than anything else. It's not actually an assumption. So the full detail of this was, and I think I've got the names right. So if you want to go and just check I'm not being too dishonest, you can go and look it up. So these guys did it properly. They allowed for some perturbation in the bulk, which then projects down to an extra term on the brain. Righty-ho, so we're going to go from, we know that we have this relation between the extrinsic curvature and the stress tensor. So we're going to say, oh, and we're going to keep Z2 symmetry. So our delta KAB is still going to be 2K plus. And that has the value given by the Israel equation. So KAB is determined by the stress tensor of the brain. But the stress tensor of the brain is now shifted a little bit. It's got a background piece, which is the same, but an assumed small little perturbation. So we're going to go back and look at our Gauss equation. If you remember this, we had this relation between our 4- and 5-dimensional Riemann tensors that had the extrinsic curvature sitting in it. So our this relation that we proved, if we take the trace, if we take the trace of the right-hand side, remember that if we take the trace here on A and C, we end up with the first fundamental form, which is like G plus NN. The G piece gives me the Ricci tensor in 5D projected onto the brain, and the NN piece gives me this extra term sitting over here. Now, if I was going to try and derive the Israel relations, I would look at where my delta function sat. So if I was going to underline, so if I was trying to derive the Israel conditions, I would focus on those pieces. K does not have a delta function in it, so that piece is regular as we move through the brain. The induced Ricci tensor is just dependent on the 4-dimensional geometry, same on both sides. That doesn't have a delta function. So by focusing on those green bits, the underlying green bits, that gives us the Israel equations. But I don't want to do that. Instead, I want to look just to the right of the brain. So I'm going to look at this Gauss relation just on one side of the brain. So in that case, I'm going to come up with an expression for the four-dimensional Ricci tensor. Because if I want four-dimensional Einstein equations, I kind of have to work with the intrinsic curvature. So this, where are we? 4 RAB. Apologies for crunching up there at the edge of the board. So what I've done there is I've said if I'm just a sliver to the right of the brain, what I do is I put in the bulk components of my Ricci and Riemann tensors. So since we're in ADS, we're in a constant curvature space, so what that means is I can actually write down what those curvature tensors are, and they're just proportional to combinations of the metric. That's the definition of a constant curvature space. And so that's the source of those first terms. In the second bit, I've said I've already found the Israel equations, and so I'm substituting for my extrinsic curvature in terms of the energy momentum of the brain. So far, what that is just simply substitution of what I know my Riemann, Ricci, and extrinsic curvature to be. So I carry on. By multiplying out that second term with the normals. And then I get a bit of a long piece here, because what I want to do is I now want to say what S is. So S is the background brain energy momentum, the 6k over 8 pi g piece, plus this extra t mu nu that we've added. so a bit long, but there you go. So my S is sigma eta plus T, so I take the trace of that and I get 4 sigma plus the trace of T, and so that's kind of where, you know, where that first piece has come from. And then, of course, the other terms in brackets are SAB minus the third SHAB. So the brain energy momentum part of that gives you this piece, and then this is the other bit coming from the perturbation. So if you kind of multiply this all out, you can see you started off with, here I've got a K squared G plus NN, so these two terms here combined to give me an H. So here I've got 3k squared h, and then if I kind of look inside the square brackets, you can see that I've also got k squared here over 4 pi g squared, cancels that. So I've got, you know, that gives me a sort of k squared h term. And then finally, this term here also gives me a k squared h piece. So in the end, I hope, in the end, those k squared terms should cancel. Although I must admit, I think I might have a sign error somewhere in there. So I'm not going to try and unravel it at this late stage. We know the k squared terms have to cancel because we know that if we have no t and g is eta, we've just demonstrated that is a solution. So therefore, our Ricci tensor has to be something that is proportional to t, and in this case we see that we get something proportional to t and something proportional to t squared. So what this looks like here, this looks like 4D Einstein gravity if we say that the Newton's constant is gk. So remember, k is like 1 over LADS, so we've got G over the ADS length scale, so that looks familiar in terms of a renormalization of G. And this is a sort of correction. So what's important to note is that that 4D Einstein piece really is the four-dimensional linearized Einstein equation. This here, if I were doing linearized gravity, this would be order t squared, and I would just delete it. So from a linearized perspective, if I look at the linearized Einstein equations, I get exactly the right tensor structure for my linearized Einstein equation. So this really gives me 4D gravity plus corrections, which are subdominant. Now, if you go the other route by doing perturbation theory, you get exactly the same result. And I just want to tell you what happens to the Schwarzschild, what the effect of the corrections are to the Schwarzschild potential. So if you put a point source on the brain and look at the gravitational field in the brain, you find it looks like Schwarzschild, but that there are extra corrections suppressed by this suppression here is of order LADS over whatever your radius is squared relative to the 1 over R. So you get not sort of exponentially suppressed corrections, which sometimes when people are modeling corrections to gravity, they may do more of a Yukawa type of modeling. Here they're power law, and that's really because of the effect of a sort of infinite continuum of modes of the graviton, that the five-dimensional graviton projected on the brain. They're still subdominant, you know, they don't contribute to the leading order term, but they kind of sum up to give you something that's power law. Is that a question or a,
yes.
A general?
No, it's so the only corrections you get are like of the order of t squared, but
yeah.
Supposedly like black holes don't have a t, right?
Yeah.
So why would they correct?
So in that case, so this is looking at, you know, where you have some extended energy momentum source. So for the black hole, what you're doing is kind of looking for a vacuum solution. And in this case, because of the effect of the extra dimension, you don't have quite the same restriction on your four-dimensional field. So what I ignored here, I ignored the bulk effects. But I'm not being too dishonest. I was just trying to get to this stage without having to carry that along with me. If you add in bulk effects, you get a trace-free tensor. You get an extra piece, which is trace-free. And that is the projection of the Weyl tensor onto the brain. Now, if you put a delta function, or, you know, you get the black hole by putting a sort of delta function source. It's like an approximation to getting the far field solution. It's perfectly legitimate for far field. So in that case, you put a delta function on the brain. That's obviously something very localized and inhomogeneous on the brain. You can't have an unperturbed bulk in that circumstance. So there are perturbations to the bulk, which I did not, you know, track through in this calculation. If the bulk changes, you've got this thing here. So this means that what you're really solving is not quite vacuum Einstein gravity. So if you like, that's these pieces you can track through to this in this language. If you do perturbation theory, you end up with something that looks like has a profile exactly like that A squared, and has, like the condensate, has zero mass excitations within the brain. That's your leading order piece, Schwarzschild. And these pieces come from the modes that have a dependence in the in the Z direction. And so once again, it ties in with the interpretation there. Okay.